Look, it was obviously, people saw it. It was a testing time, and you know, and the committee's asked a lot of questions that they were right to ask, and I think, you know, they've driven quite a lot of change by doing that. I also feel that they were unfair on a few issues and unfair on a few colleagues, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't really care about me and what they say about me. I mean, that's my job, but there are some colleagues who appeared there who I think were treated by some individuals a little bit unfairly, and I think people recognise that.
Hello and welcome again to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest is Kevin Backhurst, who's been the Director General of RTE for the past 15 months. For most of that time, he's been dealing with the fallout from revelations that exploded into the public sphere, first about underreported payments to a star presenter, then a whole series of revelations and confrontations over issues ranging from lavish hospitality to severance payments for departing executives, bogus employment contracts, presenter Nixer without proper oversight, all accompanied by a loss of confidence inside and outside the organisation and a big fall off in TV licence revenue. Kevin Backhurst, good to have you. I remember way back when you came to RTE, first as head of news and current affairs in 2012, after the station had taken a big hit with that Mission to Pray debacle when RTE wrongly accused a Catholic missionary priest, Father Reynolds, of fathering a child in Africa. Now, you stood in the middle of the newsroom on your first or second day to introduce yourself, and you said you had looked at and listened to a lot of our work and that it was very good. And you said another thing that stayed with me ever since. You said it was important that we have fun working as journalists. I can't imagine, though, that you've had much fun in your first year since you came back as Director General.
No, look, it's been pretty full on and pretty public, obviously. And as you outlined, we've had a lot of issues to deal with and a lot of serious work. I have had fun alongside it, I have to say. It's an absolute pleasure being back in Ireland. It's a real pleasure being back with some of the fantastic people that I work with here. And, you know, I enjoy, as I've said previously, I enjoy many parts of Irish life, getting around the country, cultural and sports events. And that's been, and, you know, meeting people outside work, really interesting people. So there has been fun. I mean, somewhat surprisingly, possibly more in the last few months than at the very beginning, where I was trying to limit how much I was doing outside work.
One thing that I'd imagine is completely different now for you compared to your first stint in RTE up to 2016 is that whereas previously you could live a fairly anonymous life, now you're a very recognisable figure in the street or when you go shopping or whatever. How have you found that experience?
You're right, it is different. I do get recognised quite a lot. My family find that quite amusing, I suppose. I don't mind it at all. I mean, I think, you know, this is an important public job. I said before I came to the job, and in fact, before when I accepted the job and I talked to the press team before all the kind of crisis unfolded, I said that I intended to do this differently and that I felt we took a lot of public money and that we should be more accountable and, you know, the Director General should be out there in public a little bit more. So, you know, it was always my intention to be a little bit, probably a bit more public facing and answer questions more fully than maybe we have in the past. But I have to say, yeah, look, I've had hundreds of people come up to me in the streets and in shops and elsewhere. And I would say, honestly say, all apart from one person, they've all been fantastically supportive and positive. Even during the height of the crisis, you know, at that point, there was probably more sympathy than anything else. You know, my God, did you know what you were taking on? But and even the person who wasn't outside Dublin Castle one weekend when I was going there, I stopped and talked to him for a while. And then when I came out of the castle, he came over and he said, well, good luck with the changes you're making. So, you know, I think if you engage with people, if you're as open as you can be, not everyone's going to agree with what you're doing, but people are very supportive and polite generally.
Things, I imagine now, they're a much deal calmer than they were a year ago or so. And I'd like to hear more about your version, if you pardon the phrase, of Operation Transformation for RTE a little later. But let's talk before that about you and your background and how you built a career in BBC News as a producer and channel controller. Did you have an interest in news from and broadcasting from an early age?
Yes, I did. I mean, I suppose it possibly sounds a bit strange, but my mum loves to tell the story about how she used to come downstairs at weekends when I was, or during school holidays when I was about six or seven, and find me lying in the hallway reading the paper that had just dropped onto the mat. So I was, bizarrely, it's always been an interest of mine, current affairs and news, from a very early age. And look, my mum and her father were very similar, not in the business at all, but just very engaged. And, you know, to this day, I still have quite interesting debates and discussions with my mum about, you know, world events and politics and so on.
She's from South Africa. Mm-hmm. Now, did that influence her, or did she bring some of her experiences from South Africa to bear just on family conversations? And did you become sort of partly, or was she a politicised person?
She was, and is possibly more politicised now than ever, actually. But I mean, yes, is the answer. My family were actually very involved in the anti-apartheid movement. And in fact, my cousin was in prison in South Africa. He was one of the few white political prisoners for being a member of the ANC in the 1970s. So that was very much part of my childhood. My parents were very involved with the anti-apartheid movement when I was growing up, and, you know, took me around to a number of protests and so on. And I was lucky enough to meet some very interesting figures. They were quite friendly with Oliver and Adelaide Tambo, and we used to go around to their house. I wasn't quite aware of what a big figure he was at that stage, but, you know, it was that was interesting as well.
And your father, what did he do?
He was a businessman. A number of businesses, right until he retired in his mid-70s, which was about 10 years ago.
Now, the school you went to, Kevin, has a kind of strange name, Haberdasher's Ask. I mean, what sort of a place was that?
It was a very academic school. It was a day school. It was a private school. I did get a bursary when I first went there, but then my dad got a salary increase and he lost that. But I had very happy memories of it. It was, it wasn't for everyone because it was very competitive. And, you know, I kind of did okay with that. Yes, the name's funny. It's named after one of the sort of livery companies in the city, with haberdashers who did, you know, who were involved in tailoring and, you know, things like that. That was historic. I mean, you know, the name dates from the 17th century, I think. So,
were you studious or sporty or both?
Probably both. Yeah, I one of my best friends at Haberdashers was incredibly studious. So whenever I thought I'd done a lot of work, I used to talk to him and he'd done twice as much. So it was all relative.
And then afterwards to Cambridge to study French and German.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
How did you enjoy that, or did you?
I love my time at Cambridge. I can't say hand on heart, I absolutely love the studying. I enjoyed the other aspects of Cambridge probably more. I was involved in the sort of junior common room. I was the president of the students' union in our college, with JCR it was called. I made some fantastic friends who are still friends now, friends for life. And Cambridge is an amazing place to live for three years. Yeah, and the studying. I felt a little bit. I was really shocked, actually, by how much work we had to do in French and German. It was huge, the amount of novels and plays in foreign languages we had to get through on a fortnightly basis, and the work we had to churn out. So, yeah, I can't say I enjoyed the volume, but, you know, I've always loved languages.
And then to the BBC. Was it straight into the BBC?
No, I applied for a few media jobs my last year at Cambridge and didn't get any of them or any interviews for them. So I thought the other thing I was interested in was business, and I thought one good training ground for that was to maybe do accountancy. So I applied for some accountancy jobs. I got a few offers and I went to Pricewaterhouse, but only for a short time. That wasn't the highlight of my career.
Whatever you learned there might still stand to you, though, in RT. But that
well, something... well, it was funny. I was only there for, I don't know, around 6 months, I suppose, but I remember when I was at the BBC, actually, and one or two of the accountants I worked with saying, gosh, you're the first kind of editor or journalist I know who actually understands balance sheets and profits and loss and so on. And so even that short period, you know, it's never wasted, the skills you learn in those things. Yeah. And actually, look, Pricewaterhouse was a, you know, I would say nothing against them. And that when I told the partner that I'd had a job offer from the BBC and he asked me why I wanted to leave and I explained it to him, you know, he was very good. It was a lesson for life, actually, which is, you know, I can see the passion there. I think you're doing the right thing.
And what was it that you decided you wanted to go to the BBC for?
I wanted to follow my passion, which was journalism.
Okay.
And I got offered a job as a researcher.
Huge organisation, huge resources, correspondence, bureaus all over the world. You got a huge amount of experience and exposure. The Hong Kong handover in 1997, 9/11, US elections, experience in Europe as well.
Yeah, look, it was a fantastic career. And I think I've been very lucky because I have done a job essentially which is also my hobby. And to be present at some of those events, you know, that are absolute highlights of my working life. You know, to be there when Obama was inaugurated, to be there for the Hong Kong handover, which was an end of empire moment for the UK. I'm interested in history, and, you know, to be present at these, you know when you're there, these are going to be historical events when they look back on. They're not just moments of news coverage.
How quickly did you decide, or was it always your view that you wanted to be the programme maker, stroke editor, producer, as opposed to being front of house, the John Simpson?
Relatively quickly, when I was first there, I did a little bit of reporting. Hopefully the tapes have now been lost, but I never thought that was my forte, and I don't think it was. I think it was more editorial decision-making. I also thought, you know, I remember I was the producer in Brussels with some great correspondents, James Robbins and David Shookman, Jonathan Charles, and I looked at them, you know, in their mid-40s, early 50s, still running around with camera crews, and I did think, I'm not sure that's sustainable for people to do that. And I really admire people who do it, because, you know, many years running around chasing stories, rushing to edit stories, you know, it's quite demanding.
Not to mention the aforementioned John Simpson as well. I mean, They had incredible stamina and staying power.
Yeah, and John is still there doing the job. And I think he's just had his 80th birthday party and he's still working. And I worked with John over a number of years, and, you know, he had incredible drive and stamina and authority. It was always an honour to work with him, actually.
9/11 must have been quite the experience to cover that. I mean, you obviously had to drop everything, I suppose, and head off to New York.
Yeah, well, I was actually in the gallery working for the BBC News Channel when that happened, actually, at lunchtime, UK time. And so I covered it in the newsroom for a couple of days while we waited because obviously they closed airspace straight away. So we had to wait until we could get on the first flight after they reopened the airspace, which we did. And then I went over to Washington and was mainly based in Washington, but did some work in New York for several weeks after it happened with a team.
You became editor then of some of the big news programs, the lunchtime news, the 10 o'clock news as opposed to the news at 10. What was it like managing those big teams and maybe some famous names as well?
I love being editor of the 10 o'clock news. You know, you had all the BBC sort of firepower available to you. In fact, the issue more often was about telling people they were not going to be on the 10 o'clock news. There was never a problem getting people on the 10 o'clock news. And, you know, at that stage, the BBC was pretty well funded in news and had some fantastic correspondents who I worked with and was lucky to work with. And, you know, it was still attracting very, very big audiences. And although here, the 6, 1 and the 9 still attract very high share of viewers, the British TV news bulletins audiences have been steadily declining over the years, as every news program's audience has declined. But, you know, you knew when you were covering a big story, you were doing it for 10 million people. So I like the responsibility too.
Did you ever find yourself, you know, in confrontation with some of those star names, be they presenters or correspondents?
Oh, yeah, every day. Yeah. Because they all wanted to be on the 10 o'clock news. I remember one of the programmes we actually won a BAFTA for it, which was the coverage of the Madrid train bombings, and there was an almighty row over who was doing the lead package. I won't embarrass people by naming who was involved in it, but which of the correspondents was going to do the lead package, but I had a really clear view as to who was going to do it. And you know, in the end, sometimes you have discussions and you say, look, you know, You're the correspondent. Actually, in the end, I'm the editor of the programme and I have to make those decisions.
Just by way of a sad, I suppose, digression, I gather you and the newscaster Hugh Edwards became good friends and worked together side by side for quite a time.
We did. I knew Hugh from very early days. In fact, when I was John Cole's producer at Westminster, the very famous Northern Irish political
editor. John Cole.
Yeah, exactly. I got to know all the political correspondents then, and that was Hugh, and it was Jeremy Vine and John Sopel, and, you know, some really talented people who've gone on, John Pienaar, who've gone on to do some amazing stuff. So I knew Hugh from there. Obviously, I worked with him closely when I was editor of the 10 o'clock news.
There can hardly have been a more spectacular fall than his. Yeah. First, his dealings with the young man, and latterly, then, his conviction for making indecent images of children.
Yeah, I still think for me and for everyone who knew Hugh, I mean, it is absolutely, first of all, it's absolutely shocking what he did and, you know, disgusting what he did, actually, sadly. And I really feel really sorry for all the victims of it. But, you know, when you've known Hugh and you know he was at the absolute pinnacle of his career, which is what he always wanted to do, he was presenting the Tenneco News, the BBC's general election coverage. He was the voice of the BBC for state occasions, and he'd just done the death of the Queen and done it brilliantly as well. And to go within a year or so from that to, you know, where Hugh is now, it's, yeah, you've seldom seen such a fall from grace, and unfortunately he brought it on himself. And I have to say, for, you know, for people like me and his colleagues, you knew him well, and I've spoken to a lot of them since it happened, you know, everyone's absolutely shocked and disgusted by what he did, sadly.
Have you had any contact with him since this all began to unfold? Or
no.
Could you see yourself or envisage yourself having contact
with
him?
I wouldn't now. No.
No.
Sadly, no. Because for me, there's a line that's been crossed there. And I'm afraid, you know, when you cross that line, I don't have any desire to have any contact.
What does the BBC do now, would you say, Kevin, with all that archive material in which he features the events you outlined, especially the death of the Queen and what followed?
Yeah, that's a tough one for the BBC. But, you know, I think some of those are historical moments, whether it's the funeral of Prince Philip or the death of the Queen or royal weddings or whatever. And they can't just airbrush that out of history. I mean, unfortunately, it's a very unfortunate for the BBC that is so tainted now. But I don't think they can just not show it.
Or have it accessible on archive or whatever.
Yeah, or have it accessible. I mean, you know, people know what Hugh's done. But these were important national moments for the UK, and I don't think the BBC can just scrap them.
You had a great career going, and you were still in your 40s. So what piqued your interest in 2012 or thereabouts in the RTE vacancy for Director of News and Current Affairs?
I have to put it down to one person in particular, which was Fergal Keane of the BBC. Who was and is a good friend of mine. And Fergal came to me, and he was working with me often at that stage. You know, we were and are friends outside work as well. But he came to me and said, had I considered applying for the job, which is just about to be advertised? I said no, because I'm not Irish and I don't have any Irish family, unfortunately, hard as I've looked. And he said, I don't think that's an issue. You know, you should think about it and you'd be really good at it. And I think actually it would be a good time for someone from the outside to come in. Obviously, you know, things have gone, you know, you mentioned it before, but a couple of things have gone badly wrong. So the more I looked at it, the more I thought, actually, this is an interesting new thing to do. The more I looked, as you said earlier on, I watched a lot of RT coverage, and I thought there's a lot of really great stuff there. Obviously, there were a couple of high-profile mistakes and things we needed to put right, but I also have always liked a challenge.
But a much smaller pond.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess that's true. But, it was just, I think you're right. I mean, it was something at that stage I thought it's a completely new challenge, and proving yourself again at that stage in your career in a different environment. Because I think when you get to whatever I was, you know, mid to late 40s or whatever at that point, you can take a decision, which is I'm doing fine at the BBC and I could stay here till I'm 65 and carry on doing fine. Or shall I go out and try and prove myself in a different environment?
Was there a part of you which maybe saw the RT opportunity as perhaps a stepping stone to greater things higher up in the BBC?
No. No, and I know that was something that was put to me at the time. And I've never been that good at calculating my career, to be honest with you. And I've never taken that consideration. I don't think you should do that, because I've seen people try and do that. And you go for a job, and then because you think it's part of a clever game plan, and then you get stuck there. And if it's not the right job for you, then you've made a mistake. And I don't think people should do that. I don't think... Interestingly, when I was offered the job, Noel Curran, the DG, then asked me to come over to have lunch with him, just finally before they finally offered me the job, and we had lunch. And, you know, he asked me about the future, you know, because it was obviously it was quite a high profile appointment at the time. And I think there was an element of risk for Noel as well, first British head of news here. We got on really well. And I said to him, no, like I'm not going to take this job and then leave. That's using the polite words for it, but I'm not going to leave in any short time. I've no plans. This is not a stepping stone job. It's because I'd like to do this job. And that was good enough for him.
And you really threw yourself into getting to know not just the people here in RT and working with them, but to get to know the country and the people, its culture, sport and so forth.
For me, that's been one of the great joys of my time in Ireland, both previously and currently. I've loved that. And I really have loved travelling around the island. I think it's an important part of the role as well, that you immerse yourself in the history and the culture as far as you can. But it's also one of the most enjoyable parts of the job as well. So it's been an absolute delight to do that.
And you became friendly with somebody who got you into some great positions to watch hurling and football matches in Croke Park. That was Marty, our mutual friend.
Yes, yeah. No, well, Marty's a very good friend of mine, and as people know. And yes, I mean, it was initially he invited me along to a couple of the hurling, I think, finals, and I went with him, and I deliberately wanted to sit with him while he commentated, not go into one of the boxes at that stage. Our friendship kind of developed from there, and he's a fine man.
You got to know his mother.
I did, yeah. His mother was lovely and always very welcoming when I went down to Clare, and I always used to enjoy going to see her and having a chat. And, you know, she was obviously, you know, she was in her 90s when she died, but, you know, to get to hear stories from her about her early life and their life in New York and so on, I mean, that was always lovely.
You wrote a fascinating reflective piece in The Independent as you prepared to go back to London, having spent your time as head of news and current affairs, applied for and been passed over for director general. That was in 2016. And you wrote about it, something I remember having a discussion with you about, that you saw a fascinating contrast between the Irish way of death and the English way of death.
Mm.
It took some getting used to for you, did it?
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever seen a dead body before I came here. Certainly not someone I knew. No, look, that is one of the biggest contrasts between the Irish way of life or Irish way of death and British way of life or death. And I actually think it's something the Irish get right, to be honest with you. I think death is part of life, and for it to be treated as that and to be normal, I think is much healthier than in the UK. You know, I mean, in the UK, when people would find it hard to believe here, but sometimes, you know, often when people die in the UK, you can wait weeks and weeks for the funeral or the cremation, you know, and that's not a great time. And just the sense of community at funerals here, the number of people who turn up. I mean, I always tell friends the anecdote of, you know, you go to a funeral in the UK and people turn up who didn't know the person particularly well, and everyone says, what the hell is that person doing here? Whereas in Ireland, it's the other way around. It's like, why the hell isn't that person at the funeral? And I think that's the difference. The funerals are much bigger here, but yeah. Also...
Peggy Morrissey's funeral was one that you... I mean, you went... It was quite inconvenient for you, but you felt you had to just be there, I suppose, for her and for him, for Marty.
Yeah, it was during one of the tricky COVID periods, and I was about to head off with my wife to see my son in America. We'd not seen for a couple of years because of the COVID travel restrictions, and then... Very sadly, Peggy died, and I think it was about a week or so before we were heading to Nashville. And my wife totally understood. I just said, of course, I'm going to go for that. And there was, you know, it was tricky. If I caught COVID, I wouldn't have been able to go to the States, obviously.
Yeah, Peggy Morrissey at least had the benefit of living a long life. Obviously ended very sadly with that accident. But somebody who didn't enjoy such longevity was Keelan Shandy, somebody who you worked with and actually gave an opening to with the morning news programme, and she died sadly as well.
Yes, Keelan was another person I became extremely good friends with when I was here, and with Connor and the family as well, actually. And you know, we stayed in close contact after I left the previous job here. And we actually met up here and also in London a couple of times, I think. And she was, you know, for people who didn't know her, I mean, everyone said what a wonderful, kind, clever person she was, and she was. Yeah, and, it's, you know, if there's one sadness coming back for this job, it's that Keelan's not here, because that would have been nice, and I think she would have liked to see that. But I spoke to Connor, actually, when I came back. I had lunch with him one day, and Keelan's husband, and he laughed. I said that to him, and he said, Keelan always thought you'd come back.
Did you?
No.
No. It just events led to the vacancy arising. Another thing you wrote in that piece where you said the political pressure applied at times, this is in regard to working as head of news and current affairs here, has been wearing, whether angry phone calls, hand-scrawled letters left on my desk or organised abuse on social media, not unexpected. That was your reflection and you said it was wearing. I mean, how did being head of current affairs and news here compare with what you'd left behind in the BBC?
Look, I think it's similar. I mean, similar pressures are put on the BBC because the BBC is such an important source of news, as RT is here. So inevitably for all the political parties here and in the UK with the BBC, it's really important how they're covered and if they feel they've been covered fairly or if they want more coverage or different coverage. So it's not that different. But, you know, before I came here, I wasn't head of news at the BBC. I was, senior enough in news, but there was a person above me and they had to deal with that, not me, but I had to deal with it here.
So how well prepared were you then when you came back as Director General and that controversy blew up 15 months ago or so for the level of, I suppose, disdain and venom that you and colleagues had to deal with, particularly, say, in those hearings at the committees in Leinster House?
Look, I don't think, given the intensity of that, I don't think anything would prepare you for that. I was lucky, I suppose. I'd done enough committee hearings in the UK and also while I was at Ofcom.
That's the regulatory body.
The regulatory body, yeah. The broadcasting regulator in the UK, and I'd had to do a number of committee hearings there. So you're used to that environment. Look, it was obviously, people saw it. It was a testing time, and and the committees asked a lot of questions that they were right to ask, and I think, you know, they've driven quite a lot of change by doing that. I also feel that they were unfair on a few issues and unfair on a few colleagues, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't really care about me and what they say about me. I mean, that's my job, but there are some colleagues who appeared there who I think were treated by some individuals a little bit unfairly, and I think people recognise that.
And for instance, when one TD suggested that, you know, there was more entertainment to be had in his local pub on a Friday night than he would ever get from the licence-funded RT, I mean, what did you think when you heard that? Were you tempted to have a go back?
Yeah, I was shocked to hear that. When he said, I'd rather spend the money on a round of drinks in my local pub than on the licence fee. And I just thought, paying the licence fee is the law, actually. And you're a representative of the country.
That was, I think, Deputy Griffin, was it?
It was Brendan Griffin, yeah.
Did you ever have a conversation with him about that afterwards?
No. I mean, actually, Robert Short, my colleague, pushed back on that in the committee. I think you have to pick your battles when you're in committee there. But I was a bit surprised to hear that. I thought that wasn't helpful. And, you know, Deputy Griffin was also then critical about the efforts we were making to collect the licence fee and actually, you know, I don't think his comment was particularly helpful in terms of recovery and licence fee payments.
What is the position now with the licence fee? Because I think this time last year, you know, October 2023, it was down, what, about 40% on the previous time a year earlier. Have things improved much since?
Yeah, the last several months, it's been significantly up on last year. So, you know, I think July and August particularly were good months. September was up slightly on last year. So we projected the licence fee payments would be down around 30% this year, and we're doing much better than that.
Perhaps because there's clarity now, the licence fee is not being abolished, so people will continue to have to pay it.
I think that's part of it. I think part of it is us demonstrating to the audiences that we are getting our act in order here. We've had a really good summer as an organisation in terms of coverage of the Olympics and the Euros and some really high profile important investigations, and a range of other content that, you know, I could go on and on. But I think you win back trust by showing you're running the organisation responsibly, by showing you're being much more transparent, answering questions, but also by demonstrating to the audience that there's real value there for them. And I think we're showing that day in, day out.
I want to talk a little more about that, but just first, or before that, were you watching Primetime the night Minister Catherine Martin effectively fired the new, relatively new chairperson, Shuni Rahali? I mean, you must have been thinking, this can't get any more bizarre.
I was watching it. And yeah, look, we'd had a various discussions during the evening. In fact, I'd done the 6-1 that evening, I think, and I came off, and I think the last question that Sharon Tobin asked me was, does this draw a line under everything? And I said, well, who knows? And then, you know, within half an hour of walking out, Shuin rang me and said she thought she was going to have to resign. And then events played out, as people know, and the minister appeared on prime time, and it was clear after that, I think, that there was no way back.
Mm. And then, of course, just going back to the committees, there were difficult exchanges, for instance, over a note taken by an RT solicitor, I think, of a video meeting between your predecessor, Dee Forbes, and Noel Kelly, representing Ryan Tuberty. How was that resolved in the end?
Look, in the end, we wrote to them and basically said we would give them a transcript of what was said. So we gave them a letter, which was a transcript of what was said in that meeting. It was a compromise solution. And then we said we'd show them the document in private session, which they then actually realised matched what we'd sent them in the letter 100%. There was no omissions from it. So they got the information that they needed.
And in regard to all of the probing and examinations that have gone on since, I mean, are you still dealing with the Department of Social Protection over bogus employment contracts? What's the situation there?
Yeah, we are. And we've made significant progress on resolving those. So there's one or two new officials there who have been very constructive. So we're making significant progress. And our head of HR is devoting a lot of time to that. So, you know, we're getting through that pretty rapidly. There's a few outstanding cases that will end up in the courts, because only where we think they have got their legal interpretation wrong, that's our advice, and there's significant amounts of money at stake here and points of principle. So there's a few that'll end up in the courts. We try and avoid that if possible, but the vast majority, I think, are being resolved, and we're making very good progress.
So how many people then will have had to have been reassigned or recategorised as employees who didn't have that status up to now?
I don't have the exact numbers, but I mean, I think it will be in, there'll probably be a few hundred who should have been categorised as employees, according to the
department. A few hundred?
Yeah, I think that's no surprise. I think every organisation is going through this. The interpretation of the law has, you know,
presumably there's a price to be paid then in terms of back money due to the department in terms of PRSI?
Yeah, we have to pay the PRSI, and we have to pay but potentially if there's any sort of interest or penalties. But the PRSI back payments, yeah, that's part of the deal.
So what do you think that'll run to?
Well, we have a provision in the accounts of 21 million euros. I'm not sure it's going to get as far. I'm not sure it's going to be as high as that, but we've made a fairly conservative provision, yeah.
And what about people who are the subject of those mischaracterizations? Are they owed money for holiday pay, maternity leave, all of that?
No, they're not. No, this is purely about PRSI payments. So it's not about retrospective other conditions. But the point is, quite a lot of people who are on contracts, not all of them, but quite a lot of people who are on contracts are paid significantly more to be on contract than on staff. And part of that calculation is that it's because RT is not paying a pension contribution, they're expected to pay it out of the extra money. Sometimes it's 20% more than they would be getting or similar like.
But as part of your restructuring program, are you going to have to start off, because you've got people given staff employment positions, that actually you're going to increase the number of employees in RTE?
That has happened, yeah. Mm. That has happened. I mean, that is part of our numbers.
How high do the numbers go before they start to come down then?
Well, I think we've dealt with a lot of those, to be honest with you. And, you know, a lot of the, I mean, there were, whatever it is, 650, 700 people we had to deal with. An awful lot of those were, you know, people like sports pundits who do the odd day here for us here or there, or musicians, or, you know, who we have to give employment contracts to now, even if it's only for a day or a few days or whatever. So the numbers sound much bigger than they are. There are some full-time people that we have dealt with, and there's people already on staff. Frankly, a lot of the people, you know, a significant number of people have already been regularised and already on staff, and it's just about going back to the period when they weren't on staff and looking at those. They still count as individuals there, but they're already on staff with us. But yes, we've already had to take on a number of people.
One other issue that arose, it was controversy about the exit package given to the former Director of Finance, Breda O'Keefe. Now, did RTE have to pay revenue on that, on the grounds that it didn't meet the criteria for tax relief on redundancy payments?
Well, there was a revenue liability on a few of those payments, as you've seen from the McCann report.
Was that one of them?
There was a number of them that we had to pay revenue on where they got only on a small amount, though. It wasn't on the full amount. It was on the statutory element of the payment. So, you know, people thought it might be a huge amount. The only question for revenue was about the actual statutory payment, which is a relatively small amount of any of the individuals involved.
But it did have to be paid.
It's been resolved.
Yeah. So 7 years ago, I think it was 2017, RT sold 9 acres to Cairn Homes. Now, that plan, from their point of view, is still caught up in planning. So the sod hasn't been turned yet. But what's actually happened to that pot of money? I think 107 million was the amount. The revenue got a slice of that. Mm-hmm. So I think RT was left with, what, something in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. What's all happened to that money?
There's still some of it left, but there are very clear guidelines on what we can spend it on. So it's all been spent on infrastructure, investment in technology for the organisation, particularly as we move to being an IP or a web-based organisation. So we spend a lot of it on our internal systems and digitising the organisation, and some money on some of the exit programme, the exit packages. And you know, the plan is when we get approval, again, we'll be using some of that on the initial limited exit program, exit packages that we have planned.
And will you get the 40 redundancies that you're expecting this year, I think 2024?
I don't know. I mean, we're waiting for approval from government, but we need approval from government for it, and we're still waiting for that. And I mean, being asked about that a lot, and I'm quite impatient about it, but there's a process that we have to wait for government to approve it.
But you have this overall strategy now, a 5-year strategy. Your intention is to have 400 fewer people working here over the period of that. What's RTE not going to be doing as a result of that it is doing now?
Well, as we said before, we have an obligation in the Future Media Commission recommendations that we need to spend 25% of public money in the independent sector. So we'll be doing more. We already make a huge amount in the independent sector, but we'll be doing more in the independent sector.
It's going up from what, about 47 million to what, about 70,
yes,
70 plus
that's right.
million?
Yeah, per annum. Yeah. So we'll be spending more in the independent sector. So we'll be doing less production in-house, we'll be working in a more efficient way. I mean, we are investing in technology and the ways we're working. But a lot of the, you know, frankly, you know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to actually reshape the organisation. We have, you know, thankfully now we have multi-year funding in place and it enables us to do that. And, you know, over the period of 5 years, we will be smaller. We will be doing less as an organisation, but I think we've made it clear which areas, you know, that we are still going to be doing in-house news, current affairs, sport, radio,
and
largely.
All the live programmes, essentially, or most of them at any rate. What about the Late Late Show? There seems to be a bit of doubt or ambiguity about whether that might be outsourced or will be. What's your current thinking?
Well, there's no ambiguity is we will have to make that off-site, as we'll have to make Fair City off-site, because we're going to be closing the TV studios building. Because we can't afford to refurbish.
And has some of that Cairns Homes money gone into that TV studio building, which is now being closed?
Well, it would have done, yeah, for you know, upgrading the new studio. But, I mean, we'll have got a number of, you know, 10 years of use out of that, which is quite a long time in broadcasting. Yes, so some money has gone into, I'm sure, gone into the infrastructure. You know, but in the digital world, you put money in there, you probably only expect to be using that for 5 to 10 years. By the time we move out, a lot of that technology will need upgrading anyway.
So the Late Late goes off-site, but what about the actual making of the show and where editorial input and control lies? Is that an open question?
It's an open question. The one thing I would say is that this is a really important show for RTE, and you know, there is no way we're going to compromise the quality or the editorial integrity of it.
But it's so much a part of RT. I mean, it's, you know, part of the marrow of the bones of
it
the
is.
Place.
And it will remain that. And if anything, it will be enhanced, because if we move it off-site, we can get a bigger studio. The current studio is really not big enough for it. As we know, there's, you know, the demand for tickets, particularly for the toy show, but generally far outstrips what we can provide for audiences. And actually, you could potentially have a studio off-site which has twice the capacity for audiences and, you know, much greater capacity for musical acts and all that sort of thing. So it is an absolutely critical programme for RTE. I'm really delighted with how Patrick Kilty's done in that role and the changes the team have made to the programme. you know, how we move it off site, you know, we need to discuss that and, you know, look at it. But I, it's editorially very sensitive, and I, you know, there's no way that RT will be giving up oversight of that one way,
yeah,
whatever,
I mean,
way we do it.
If you let the Late Late Show go or be diminished in RT's control and making of it, it begs the question, is nothing sacred?
I don't think it does beg that question, Sean. It's not going to be diminished in any way. It's going to be enhanced, as I say. And
but if you hand over the making of it to an independent producer?
Well, I would argue that, do you know, I mean, it depends what you mean by the making of it. Do you mean the editorial or do you mean
everything?
The opera? Well, we may hand over parts of it, we may not. I mean, we have yet to talk to independents about how we're going to do this and where we're going to do it. We don't have any choice but to move it off-site. But it is you're absolutely right. It's an absolute jewel in our crown. And, you know, there's no way we're going to diminish that program. Mm. If anything, it's going to be enhanced. And, you know, I would argue we make an awful lot of really high quality, high audience programs off-site with independents, whether that's Dancing with the Stars, whether it's significant number of our documentaries. All of our drama, apart from Fair City, is made by independents. You know, and if anything, you know, the quality of all of that programming over the years has improved. I mean, the drama is absolutely world class now and is, you know, selling around the world. So we're working really successfully with some fantastic independent production companies out there. So there should be no fears about the quality or the future of The Late Late. You know, we will absolutely ensure that, you know, if anything, it's more ambitious and a better program.
When would you expect to decide?
Well, we have 5 years in terms of, you know, when we need to get out of the buildings here. I mean, I think people who don't know the buildings on Donnybrook won't be familiar with actually the state they're in. I mean, that particular building, 60 years old, the roof is leaking. You know, we're doing running repairs. Some of the glazing fell out last year. We had to repair that. And each time you do that, it's hugely expensive. It's not sustainable in terms of the climate requirements that we want to meet and we're required to meet over due course as well. So, you know, the price tag for staying in there. And also the studios are not big enough. You know, they're 60 years old. No one would choose to make The Late Late in a studio that size now if they had a choice about it.
And another element of your strategy is to have more of the RT workforce based outside of Dublin, I think, to go from 13% to 20% mm-hmm. at the end of that period. I mean, as long as I've been around here, people have been talking about the regions and greater input from the regions. I mean, Joe Barry, God rest him, brought the Eurovision from Mill Street back in the day, and Cork, and then Nationwide was seen as a serious advance in regional coverage input. I mean, what can you do to add to that?
Well, one thing we've already said is we will be investing in a new centre in Cork, and that is one of the priority projects because, again, our building there. The team do a fantastic job down there, but it's, you know, they're battling with a building that's not fit for what they do. So to give them premises where they can work properly, we'll be investing in Cork. We've already got a very good base in Cork. We make a lot of good programs from down there. And we have a lot of extremely strong partnerships with UCC and other organizations down there. We make a lot of our nature and music programs, and obviously the Today Show. And Nationwide. So we're building off a strong base. We're planning on making that a centre of excellence for our podcasts as part of the strategy. You know, so we have ambitious plans. And part of it is also about working with the independent sector increasingly. And I know there's already significant interest in Cork. I've met some of the companies who want to work more closely with us. And, you know, we'll look at what other shows we might be able to make down there as well.
Have you got a figure in mind as to what you're going to spend or what the outlay on an annual basis for these new programmes and initiatives is going to be?
No, because Steve Carson, our new head of video and TV, has got very strong views about the sort of programming he wants us to invest in. And, you know, a lot of that will be made outside Dublin, including in Cork. So, you know, I would expect him to come in and, you know, when he has had his time to get his feet under the table to input into that. So in the next few weeks, we'll have a really clear view about what we want to do in Cork and therefore the facilities we need.
And you've got a new head of radio and audio as well, Patricia Monaghan, who has joined the station from News Talk. What kind of an instruction has she been given by you? I mean, are you telling her to shake up things on radio, or what are the plans there?
No, I hesitate to give any instruction. I mean, she She certainly joined us because she thinks the strategy is the right strategy. You know, she's someone with huge ability and a great track record, both in terms of editorial, but also in terms of people management and so on. And, you know, she's only been here a short time, but she's already made a great impression. And look, there are areas that she's going to look across the piece, but there are areas we don't need huge changes to. There are decisions we're going to have to make when some presenters move on and so on. But, you know, she's very much, I think, in a similar model to me. She wants to come in and see what works and what needs attention. And, I mean, clearly there are already changes underway at 2FM, and she'll input into that in a significant way.
And do you expect as well that radio, you're going to see more programmes outsourced or going to the independent sector in radio as well as television?
There may well be. I suspect that, look, the independent sector in radio in Ireland is probably less developed to do that. There may be, but that's not a significant part of the plan at the moment. And, you know, particularly on, you know, we have a very efficient operation for Lyric down in Limerick. Radio 1, a lot of the programmes are news and current affairs, and we would not outsource those. So, you know, there's limits to where we might go in that.
And as we know, you know, the station took a terrible pounding over the toy show, the musical. Now, that was something that RT embarked on. You could say it was risky, but with all of the stuff that's all the derision and investigations and supervision and accountability that's happened since all those events unfolded, where is the scope now for risk-taking in RTE? Because, I mean, the last thing people might want to do is take anything that might, you know, incur the wrath of the politicians or the PAC. You know, so play safe might have to be your watchword.
Yeah, that's the last thing I want, really. If you're a creative organisation, you have to be prepared to take risks. And we do it every day, whether it's deploying people to war zones in news and current affairs, whether it's high-profile investigations, there's always a level of risk in that. Or whether it's creative risk, you know, you, unless you're prepared to take a risk, you know, some of the best creative ideas will never see the light of day. And I think the key thing, the key lessons, I think, for us and for any organisation are you need to consider the risk properly and know what your appetite is for risk, but not eliminate risk. You can't. You just need to show that it's been properly considered, particularly where there's a lot of money involved, that the process is right, it's been properly considered. If you take a risk, look, not every creative risk is going to work. I think it's really important for the organisation that we don't become too risk averse. It's just we need to properly consider what those risks are.
Have you anything in mind that would fall into that category?
Yeah, look, any big investment in new programming, for example, I mean, I'm certainly not planning on any new theatrical excursion. But any big investment in new programming is always creative risk, and you don't know until you do it whether it's going to be successful or not. You know, and I think anyone who's been in this business for a period of time will have taken creative risks, and not all of them work. But you just need to show you've properly thought about it.
One of the things you've done in regard to increasing or enhancing credibility and accountability and transparency is to be more open about not just presenter salaries but executive salaries as well. How do you think that's gone down inside and outside the station?
Well, I think the general principle of transparency is a good one. Certainly the cap on presenter salaries has been extremely well received outside the station by anyone I talk to, whether that's politicians or members of the public or stakeholders or whatever. The visibility around executive or senior leaders' salaries now, I mean, it was unfortunate the way they came out because it was presented with the pension contributions and everything. So it wasn't really fair on the individuals. They are well paid, but everyone knows roughly what people on the leadership team are paid because we've kind of rehearsed that anyway, and people know when we advertise jobs. So it's not any surprise, but they were presented with pension contributions and any other contributions as well. So it looked like they were earning a lot more than they are actually as their base salary. They're well paid jobs, but they're extremely highly pressurized, and we have to get the right people. Like, if you're going to run the organization properly, and you know, I'm not that apologetic for it. It does look like a lot of money, but we are competing in a market. And, you know, if you want to bring in a new commercial director or a new CFO and you don't pay properly, you don't get good people. And we have got fantastic people come on board, both our new CFO and new commercial director. The existing people on the leadership team, they could walk out of this organization and earn twice as much tomorrow. in the independent sector or in the UK or whatever, if they really wanted to.
And does that concern you that people might be lured away because you've effectively tied your hands about what you can pay people?
Yeah, look, there's always a balancing act on that. We may lose some talent, presenter talent. And the presenters, we're extremely lucky. We have fantastic presenters here and they're all, you know, really, they do a great job. They're very valued. You know, I think the annual kind of publishing of salaries used to be a horrendous kind of event for everyone. I think hopefully the heat's gone out of that a little bit now because people think we've got a handle on it. Look, there are independent broadcasters in Ireland who are paying more than we are for talent. So we may lose some people, as we have done in the past. But, you know, we also have a depth of talent here as well.
The other thing that you set out to do was to have a register of interest, which I think, or my sense is, that that caused maybe more discomfort to some presenters than the publication of salaries, that and it would be publicised. Your initial plan was that there would be lists and names and amounts and gigs and nixers all published and going to the public domain. But you didn't actually achieve that because of concerns expressed by the regulator under GDPR. So what's the current situation on that?
Well, the current situation, look, and we've released the papers under FOI, so everyone knows that there was a process. The initial indications from the regulator were that they were okay with it, and then they were not. And we went through a process, and they, in the end, instructed us not to put out the individual amounts. We are still collecting the amounts for the Register of External Activities, so we know what people are doing, and we know there's no conflicts of interest, and people have to get permission to do those things. We had that information internally. We put out a summary of it, which is the best we can do at the moment. And we had to, you know, we've had to ask for change in legislation from the department to publish the more detailed lists.
And do you intend to do that still?
We have asked. Yeah, we've asked the department, but we would rely on that legislation.
Yeah, but might it have led to a situation where, say, in the case of 2FM, arguably some presenters took fright and don't work here anymore?
It might have done. And not in the case of 2FM. I mean, those presenters left for, you know, they were very good. They left for a variety of reasons.
Even partly that? Over the register of interest?
It could have been partly that. They all told me that that was not the main reason that they left. In fact, you know, I spoke to all of them, some of the agents as well, and they all told me that that was not the factor. There were other driving factors why they decided to leave.
What's been the most difficult decision you've had to take since becoming Director General?
Oh, so many. Look, a lot of it's centred around individuals and people because, you know, there were people who were caught up in the issues, not entirely their own making, sometimes partly their own making, you know, who'd done an amazing job for audiences or for RTE over a number of years. And when you take decisions where there are individuals who pay a price for it, that's always the hardest decision because, you know, you have to, in the end, you're a human being. You have some compassion for this, but, you know, those are the toughest decisions, probably.
I would surmise that it was a really difficult thing for you to decide to allow Ryan Tuberty to go back on radio, and that was the plan, and then maybe an even more difficult decision to reverse that decision.
Yes, that was one of the tricky decisions. And as I said publicly before, like I knew Ryan when I was here last time, and I liked him personally, and he's talented. And I thought the fair thing, and because I thought RTE should take the majority of the blame for that whole issue, but not all the blame. And so I thought in the end, the fair thing was to try and put him back on radio so long as he and the people around him would take some responsibility for it. And in the end, as I've said, that didn't happen. So we couldn't do it.
Is there any unfinished business between RTE and Ryan Tuberty or his representatives as we speak in October of 2024? I mean, there have been suggestions that he might have been about to sue RTE. Is there anything like that in the pipeline?
There's no legal actions.
Any other actions? Is there continuing correspondence or engagement?
Look, we still deal with Noel Kelly because he represents a number of other on-air people for us. So, yeah, we have ongoing business. I don't personally, as I've said before, but obviously we deal with him as we should. He has a business to run.
Finally, Kevin Backhurst, Director General, in the depths of all of this crisis that has unfolded and maybe eased off, somebody we both know said to me about working in RTE that up to then, before this crisis erupted, that it was a source of pride to them that they worked in this organisation. And then it became, well, it was something that you didn't boast about, but that you admitted to, and it was maybe a source of embarrassment. How do you see that now? When do you think people like that, who are very loyal and hardworking and not necessarily, you know, earning big money, will be able to say with pride that they work in RTE?
Well, that is where we need to get back to as an organisation. And yes, I've heard that from many members of staff, that particularly during that depth of the crisis and when we were getting huge exposure across the media and in the committees, you know, and people were rightly angry outside at what had gone on in RTE. Everyone who worked for RTE felt that deeply themselves, but also was subjected to a level of criticism, stroke abuse sometimes. I certainly get the feeling that's diminished to a large extent. And you look, my job is in the end to make this an organisation and to make sure it re-establishes itself as an organisation that people are extremely proud to work for, that they love coming to work, that they enjoy their job, that we're a vibrant organisation, that we are prepared for the future, we're going to be sustainable, we're going to deliver for audiences, that we're ambitious creatively. And I think you got a sense of that during the Olympics in the summer, actually. You know, the team in sport did an absolutely fantastic job on the Olympics, and they all worked incredibly hard, and it was a really, you know, it was a big summer of sport generally, so they had a relentless summer. But I know I've spoken to many of them since they came back, and I've thanked them for what they did, and, you know, not just the sports team, but the technology team and so on who enable that to happen. And, you know, it's those kind of things. We need to do that again and again and again, deliver for audiences, show how brilliant this organisation can be. And I know from going around the organisation, you know, there are some fantastically talented people here who are waiting to be given the opportunity. And some of them waited too long for that. And, you know, it's about giving people the opportunity to thrive and be proud of their work again. And that, look, whenever I finish at RTE and I've got a 7-year contract, you know, if I can leave here where the organisation is respected and loved and trusted by audiences and people are proud to work here again and actually have fun in their job, then that's what I'd like to my legacy to be.
And of course, there's nothing like a general election to get the creative juices flowing.
Yeah, so bring it on.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.